In Seattle, Washington, I'm Zach Jabal, and this is the Vine Pair Podcast. And a quick note before we jump into today's episode, this podcast is co-funded by the European Union. Views and opinions expressed are, however, those of the authors only and do not necessarily reflect those of the European Union or France Agromare. Neither the EU nor the granting authority can be held responsible for them. All right, with that out of the way, I really want to welcome two fascinating, exciting guests onto the podcast today. The first is Jean-François Marmier, or Taz, as we'll be referring to him today, who's a farmer and producer of Comté cheese. Taz, thanks so much for your time.
Hello, bonjour, all the US.
And our second guest is Raphael Pommier. He's a seventh generation winemaker at his family's Rhone Valley estate, Domaine de Cuisignac. Did I butcher that name, Raphael, or did I get it all right?
It's fine, thank you. Hello.
Okay, but for our listeners, how do you actually pronounce the estate?
It's the Domaine de Cuisignac.
Cuisignac. Okay, I wasn't too far off.
No, you weren't not that bad.
Yeah, and actually, that's a great place for us to start. Will you tell us a little bit about, Raphael, starting with you, a little bit about the estate and kind of what you do and where you do it?
Well, you said I'm a winemaker, so I'm a producer. I'm located in the middle of the Rhone Valley, right between the northern side, you know, the side of the Syrah, and the southern side, the side of the Grenache. Exactly a small department named Ardèche. It's a very natural area. There's no train, actually, no highway, and a lot of beautiful terraces where we cultivate our grapes. So that's my job. Every day I'm going out and trying to do the best my terroir.
Excellent. And Taz, for people who are not familiar in particular, and we'll talk more actually in our second episode about how Comté is made, but for people who are not super familiar, what role in the production of this, you know, famous cheese do you play?
Personally, a farmer, producer of Comté cheese for about 30 years with three partners. I think it's important to say that we work together. And often it's a pleasure to leave the farm and to go to taste. And I'm part of the two jury terroir and jury control, to check the quality of the Comté and to identify the different aromatic profile we have into the Comté.
Fascinating. And as mentioned, for those of you who are curious, we will dive into this. And it's a two-part series here. We will dive into more about each of what these two gentlemen do and the products they make in the second episode. But this first episode is really going to be a little bit more talking about a lot of the shared commonalities and values that the two of them and these two, you know, kind of products share. And to start with that, Taz, I want to ask you, you know, we talk a lot, and, you know, Vine Pair as a publication and this podcast in particular definitely talks a lot more about drink than we talk about food. But my understanding is that with something like Comté cheese, a sense of place or terroir, as you might call it, and as we might call it too, is hugely important here as well. Can you talk a little bit about how that comes to play in something like a cheese in the way that might be similar to or different from a wine?
Yes, it's fundamental and important to understand. To make clear first, it's important to remind people that Comté has been made for more than 1,000 years. But to go back to more recent time, it's in 1952. There was a work to define the guideline specification, and we got the AOC, which we became the AOP in 1996. So first of all, we focus on an area. That's the Jura area, a place where you have to live. And then you must have a specific breed of cow. We like the other cow, but remain only Montbéliard and French Simmental. Okay. And our cow graze outside on a permanent grass. That's very important. And that they eat dry fodder, no fermented food, hay in winter, first cut and second cut. Then we have to milk our cow twice a day. We refresh our milk, important for the temperature and the all the indigenous flow in it. So we refresh to 12 degrees, okay, maximum. And then it goes to a cheese dairy where we are allowed to pick up the milk at a radius maximum 25 kilometers, okay? So very important to preserve those different dairying area and particular taste.
That's very fascinating. And then, so the idea being, and for people who aren't necessarily familiar, that even perhaps, and as you mentioned, that there are dairies throughout the Jura, and that in each of these cases, they're really bringing in milk from very local cattle. Does that mean that throughout you might find some differences in Comté, even within the Jura, that Comté from one part might be a little bit different than others?
Absolutely. Without talking directly about cru, like for wine, we definitely, in according the area, the type of soil, we have, as we talk about permanent grass, they are all different. The stage of the grass, as we start from 200 meters elevation up to 1700 meters, the stage will be different. And of course, our practice as well, the touch of the farmer, the cheesemaker, and the affineur will contribute to that particular taste. So, of course, there is, to make it clear from the beginning and to make very important to understand, there is no one Conte, but hundreds of different kind.
Yeah, and Raphael, that's obviously something that I'm more familiar with in the world of wine, and the Rhone Valley and the Côte d'Aron is a great example of this. But, you know, for you, when you think about your wines, when you think about your grapes, you know, what are some of the ways in which you've kind of feel this sense of place, this terroir expressing itself, either in the finished wine, of course, or even in the process along the way?
That's a very good question. You know, every time I make wine, sometimes I feel like a composer, you know. In fact, I'm doing the same work as a musician. I am a writer, a composer, interpreter of my own soil, my own place. And my instruments are, well, the varietals I'm cropping in the Rhone Valley. So I have 12 varietals at the winery. And the Rhone Valley, we can use up to 23 different varietals. You can imagine the composition of music we can create. It's mainly, of course, Grenache and Syrah, because that's the base, that's our core, you know, of value. But around that, we like to add some little instruments. And every time, every vintage, there is a different weather coming to now, more and more. And it resonates inside me, inside my terroir, my soil, my grapes. So I will play every time a melody that will be different, that will resemble me. You know, my neighbors will have another way of doing it because he's another winemaker. Maybe he likes, you know, I don't know, a saxophone, and I like violin. So we will use the same grapes, but we will transfer it into our own emotions. And in fact, wine, well, will be filled up with that. Every vintage brings a different emotion, a different taste, but it's still the same mood. Eh? You are in the same Rhone Valley. So it's going to be joyful. It's going to be happy. It's going to be tasty. But it's going to be different. And that's the combination. Terroir is a mixture of all that. The soil, the type of grape varietals, the weather, and of course the mood, the rhythm of the winemaker.
And I'm realizing now that I've been a little remiss. One of the things that we want to mention on this is that one of the things among many that Comté and the Côte d'Aron share is this protected designation of origin, an EU kind of classification that, for listeners who are more familiar with the individual classification systems for wine and in nations in the EU, is an attempt to sort of bridge, I guess you would say, that and combine it with all of these classic and beautiful foodstuffs, be they cheese or other olive oils, etc. And so this kind of shared classification system and this shared focus on place and tradition and preserving these, not just the products themselves, but the reputation of them, is obviously a big part of what this system is about. For you, Taz, when you think about kind of that idea of sort of the legacy of Comté, as you mentioned, you know, not just the 70 odd years of official recognition, but thousands of years of tradition behind it. What does that mean in terms of kind of keeping things going and remaining, I guess I would say, you know, almost to bring in Raphael's kind of comparison, right? You want to continue to make the same, you know, beautiful music, but you also necessarily have to adapt as conditions around you, as demand around you changes. So kind of how do you balance that tradition with what's going on in 2023?
As we say, I'd like to say for Mr. Conte, as we say, tradition and modernity. Some of the things you don't cheat with, some of the recipe, we talk about the breed of cow, we talk about the way we treat them, their grace, what they eat in winter when they are inside, how do we milk. Those things won't change, must not change. And if we are here today, it's thanks to a big job that our ancestors has been doing. So that's very important. And of course, with the new challenge of the environment, it's a kind of a obsession, is to treat and to respect our environment, to respect the diversity, because that diversity is also a kind of a kind of natural protection in terms of diversity of grass, which is going to give a diversity of taste. So we tend to increase even more that effort in terms of quantity of acres or hectares that the cow will have to eat. It doesn't matter if we have, like it did happen last summer, sometimes a harder time, we will produce less. We are not focusing on the yield per cow. Okay, we are focusing on adaptable cows, easy cow going, and to treat them the best we can. Okay, so that's very, very important. And of course, as long as we do like this, we can talk about sustainable agriculture and to transmit this to next generation.
And for you, Raphael, you know, the connection to history, I mean, I don't think it's maybe a coincidence that when you were talking about musical instruments, you talked about playing the violin, such as it is. You know, do you feel like a strong connection to the traditions and history of winemaking, not just maybe in your family, but in your region? And how do you balance that against kind of more modern technique or just the market demands, et cetera?
Well, that's a very good question, because we are going to talk about tradition and transmission also. You said I'm coming from a seventh generation family of winemaker, and in the Rhone Valley, many, many winemakers are, you know, farmers who never moved. First of all, because they are very well here. It's a nice area with beautiful sky, sunny, a nice wind, sometimes too much windy. Anyway, that's the environment is appealing, and the environment is changing, so that's challenging. The fact is that we don't want to lose two essential directions. First of all, we don't want to lose the quality of our product. That's very important to us. So we need to maintain the tradition, the good clues, the good ideas that the ancients decided or find out after experimentation. That's what we want to keep. And after that, we need to keep our identity. Our identity is, the type of grapes we grow, the type of wine we're able to make, like I said, the joy it could bring to us. It has to remain the same. But that is not possible in an environment that will change all the time. And the thing that we need to focus on is the adaptability of our work. And in fact, it's the farming way. You have to adapt your work to the changing conditions, to the even to the taste of your consumers, you know, because if you want to sell a wine, I don't know, in the United States or in Japan, it might be different because they don't eat the same thing. And that's why you're going to create a diversity, but you don't want to lose your identity in the same time. And it's a tiny little path that we have to follow in order to maintain what's mainly important in our work, as I said, quality, identity, and of course, the pleasure of drinking this wine. So adapting my work, I do that all the time because I'm focusing on those directions.
You know, I want to come back, Taz, to something you said in a moment ago, and I think it's really interesting to get both of your perspectives on this, because we've touched on this, and I think we'll talk a little bit more about sustainability in a bit. I want to get into some of that, but in a more broad sense, you know, you talked about last year with maybe a more difficult year and difficult harvest, you know, being paramount to make sure that you're not that you're taking care of the cows and that you're not necessarily just going after maximum yield, but of course, preserving quality and also the quality of life for your cattle. And I think for most of us, we can sort of understand what it means to treat a cow well. I mean, even if we don't know the specifics of being a farmer, we can kind of understand. But I do get the sense that this is something that's important for both of you. And while a grapevine may be a little harder to recognize when you may be treating it well or poorly, at least from the outside, would you both say that, like, A, that's of course important, and B, how do you go about taking care of the living being that you rely on for this product?
So what we can do to face that and to adapt them, it can be, first of all, outside, a choice of pasture, a choice of field. Some fields are more open, some fields are more closed because we've got plenty of forest, we've got plenty of hedges. So in according to the temperature, in according to the weather, if it's windy or not, we're going to choose certain pasture. Then, of course, we allow them sometimes to come back to the farm, to come back to the building, when we have shelters as well, to eat sometimes some hay as well during the summer. It can happen sometimes. And also we equipped more and more our farms with fans. And we can see it because sometimes they come back because they know they will meet a fan. They will make those new fancy fog system to put some dew and then to bring them really a comfort for the milking and when they stay inside. And sometimes we have to push them a little bit because they would like to stay longer inside.
I know that feeling very well. And Rafael, how about for you? How does sort of taking care of your vines, what does that look like and what does it mean to you?
Well, I like to compare my work with some human aspect. First of all, when we start to prune the vines, we are in January. January, it's the beginning. It's the moment where you conceive the conception of your quality of your wine. And then 9 months later, we're going to deliver a new wine. 9 months. You see what I mean? I mean, for me, it's kind of a pregnancy, and I'm working around me. I have thousands of vines, thousands of mummies ready to produce. The first 3 months, they are very shy. The leaves are small. Sometimes they get some small disease, but then it goes away because we don't have to do it. You don't have to give them medicine. It's okay. It's normal. And then after, the grapes are going to grow, and it's so you need to take care of them and not to cure them because they're not sick. It's only a way of receiving the weather, the change, the environment, and to pay attention. So we have a lot of checking the environment. We work the grass. We cut the leaves. We plow in the middle. We can give some treatment also. Yes, of course, but mainly organic. There's more than 28% of grapes are now organically cultivated in the Rhone Valley, and more than 80% are environmental oriented with sustainable environment procedure. So it's very intense. And we try to manage, in fact, the contradiction between producing and taking care of those mummies. But anyway, let me assure you, at the end of the September, we never know when the baby is going to come. And that's just the beginning, because that was the grape. After comes the work of the wine. And that is another way. It's raising this child coming to us, teaching him how to resist to oxidation, how to age well, to learn more, to blend them, to bring them some other grape varietals in the surrounding area. Let's talk together. You see, we're going to do something more with that. That's another level. Well, we have two different actions. One in the field, which is about those mummies with a lot of attention. And one is about a child that is going to grow and that you're going to meet after when you open a bottle.
It's really interesting, Rafael, and I think this is something else that I wanted to ask about. We talk a lot about with products like these, these sort of PDO products, which are so much about a sense of place, about the sort of connection to the natural world. And in many cases, these sort of, whether it's vines, whether it's cows, et cetera. But we don't always think about also the amount of sort of skilled human labor that goes into making these come to be. And, you're talking this sort of childbirth analogy reminds me that for most people, childbirth, if you go through it in one form or another, I guess we all go through it in one form for sure, is something where, you want to have people who know what they're doing around you. And obviously there's lots of different ways to do that. But similarly, Rafael, maybe starting with you, can you talk a little bit about some of the sort of skilled the human labor that goes into this, that especially, you're talking about things like pruning, right? You're talking about things like harvest. Those are not things that just happen. They're things that people do. Kind of how does that play into your work?
Well, that's requests a lot of skills, and I have to say a lot of attention, because every step will have an impact on the result. We have 270 days roughly to produce grapes. You have days where it's going to rain, days where it's going to be too cold to prune or too warm, too hot to work outside. So sometimes you don't have a lot of time to act. And of course, the labor force is very important, mostly because that time is sometimes short. When we need to go there, it's the moment, you can't lose it. Like when the spring starts, well, grass grows everywhere, not only in one field, in all the fields around. So if you get late, well, the last fields are going to be over, we won't see the vines. So many grass will be around. So you really need to activate. And that's why a lot of producers now are working also during the night, because the, in the night they have this ability to work with less wind, with a cooler temperature, and they take their time. It sounds strange, but that's a lot of work has been done now very early in the morning or late in the evening to reduce the amount of heat that will stress the vines and also the vine growers. After that, this work, as I said, changed in the winery, and it's a complete different world where we do not talk more about nature. We talk about ecosystem, because in the wine you have some yeast, some bacteria, you have you have a lot of life, and this life, well, we need also to take care of this life. And that needs a lot of attention. So you have many helps, many hands going around to clean the tank before, you know, like I said, to clean the room of the baby, but also to make sure the temperature inside is good for the fermentation, to control all that, and then to work to move it, to change it regularly, to get the maceration in order to get some more taste. And all the way up to the bottling, because the bottling also, if you let it, if you don't do it well, you could have an oxidation, and you've lost the fruits of your wine. So that's very picky. It's very tricky, even, because wines is a lot of small steps, and we need a lot of, attention.
For sure. And Tess, how about on the Comté side, on the cheesemaking side, what are some of the ways in which, you know, human labor comes into play here that we may not necessarily think about, or that some that we may think about?
First, we have to mention that tradition, which give that kind of passion. And in fact, in our county, it's where we have the highest number of young farmers, if you compare with the rest of France, coming on a farm, taking over, and being that with that motivation. And also, even if more and more young guys are coming from outside the agriculture, they are not all the times a son of a farmer. And then on the cheese dairy, of course, we have school. But when you go to school, where also more and more ladies are going into those school, and thanks to the modernization of the equipment, they can work into the cheese dairies. But you really need to be passionate, because you learn in a way. But then you have to make Comté. And the problem is, it's changing every day. So you have to put things on perspective and really to adapt yourself and really to, in order to become a very, very good cheesemaker. Talking about the affineur in the aging cellar, there is no school for that. But we can notice that all the affineurs, very often, the most part of them, they pick up kids around, not very far, very often issued from farming or cheesemaking, because it's probably those deep-rooted side, and they are passionate, they are already into it. And then they learn by tasting, and then they can become autonomous after a couple of these 3 years. So there is really a kind of excitement around all that chain in between farmer, cheesemaker, and affineur, with that permanent communication. And it does really create a particular atmosphere, yes, and motivation, that's for sure.
You know, I'm going to switch gears just a little bit, because I've been thinking about something you were saying before, Taz, and it really resonated with me and really makes me kind of curious about this for both of you. You know, we think sometimes when we think about, certainly we think about wine, we think about the vineyard and sort of not a lot about the surrounding landscape. And perhaps even when it comes to something like Comté and raising cows, we think about pasture land, but we don't always think about the surrounding environment. And yet, part of, I think, what defines these terroirs, what defines these places and these products is not just the specific land that's used for cultivation, but everything around it and the biodiversity that's preserved within it. So, you know, Taz, you talked about sort of moving cows from sort of more open pasture into more shaded pasture and forest. How does kind of this act, what does it mean to kind of have that diversity, that biodiversity around you, and how do you kind of keep that biodiversity intact?
So it means it's very important, this rotation in terms of grazing. So we cut all the surface we can have around the farm, and in according to the climate, in according to the weather, in according to the rainfall, we're going to leave them to make a kind of pressure on the grass on a different time and at a different length. We may leave them a couple of days on one pasture or longer to another pasture. But what is very, very important to respect some rotation to renew the grass, okay, and for the quality of that grass. That's very, very important. And also to go in more covered place when you have hedges, trees, very important to allow them to go through and to participate to the renew and to the diversity. And when we talk about interesting prairie for Conte, we talk about 30, 40 species of flower. That's very, very important.
And Rafael, how about for you? Like, what is having, you know, sort of biodiversity in the vineyard or in the area surrounding you? What does that look like for you? And how do you feel like it has an impact on your wine?
Well, it has a strong impact because actually that's where you will have the influence of the nature around. We have a lot of parcels, you know, terraces, and in between you have a lot of woods, a lot of trees, grass. It's very there's a lot of diversity. The Rhone Valley has so many different soil bedrocks. You get some limestone, you get some granite, you get some metamorphic soil, sedimentary soil, and all that brings every time a different environment. And we need to keep it alive because there are the reserve we can use in case the climate is changing. So that a lot of winemakers are taking care of that. We do not plant vines everywhere. Once you know a flat area with thousands of acres, because that does not exist in the Rhone Valley, we like to keep it small. Even if there is a lot of vines, of course, it's a big production area. It's spread on a very large amount of department. We have 6 departments for about, I think there is about 160,000 acres of production, and that's a lot, but there's way more acres of natural area around. We have what we call Observatory of Agricultural Biodiversity in the Rhone Valley, and we have about 100 winemakers. They are conducting some observation to see how many bugs, how many birds, how many, I mean, life is around the parcels. And that's very important. It shows us that it's very vibrant, very alive, and we need to keep it that way. So that's the idea. And that's why some of the people are treating in the night their vines, because in the night when the bees are in the beehives, the birds are in the nest, they don't disturb them. And it's all a combination of paying attention to this ecosystem versus working the vines.
Well, that's, you know, really interesting to hear, and I really appreciated hearing kind of all the various ways in which these two distinct and iconic products of France and of Europe share similarities. I'm really excited. We're going to be doing a second episode. So we'll be back with the both of you very soon, talking a little more about some of the specifics. I'd love to get into a little more of the details. But to wrap things up here, just wanted to kind of end on this question and something for us to think about as we move into our second episode. Those of you who will be joining us again on the next episode, hopefully listening to this, can think about this too. You know, we talk a lot about these kind of we have a tendency to talk about things like wine, like cheese, often as sort of individual products, things that exist. You know, we talk about the individual bottle of wine or an individual cheese, and obviously we understand and know that these things are products of a larger community. They're products of a large tradition. But I'm also curious for the both of you, you know, with your sort of careers and lives being in a lot of ways built around each of these, you know, these things, for you, Taz, this cheese, for you, Rafael, these wines, you know, what do they mean to you? What does Comte mean to you, Taz, at this point in your life? Like what does that, when I say that, or when you think about it, what does it bring to mind?
It's really a love for Comte. And personally, really, I came back as a farmer. I was not quite sure, but I definitely came back because there is the love for the cheese. And it means, and it's so exciting, because every time I spend on a farm, every meters we do, we think about the final product. There is that permanent connection with the final product, with our cheese dairies, with the different tasting we do. And our life is really revolving around the Comte. We are really dependent of that Comte cheese. That's a very, that is obvious.
Fantastic. And how about for you, Raphael? When we think about Ardèche or the Côte d'Aron or any of these things that kind of resonate with you, what comes to mind?
I agree with Cass. The connection is everywhere. And as a winemaker cultivating vines, you know, it's my root, in fact. I feel it in my blood. I feel it in my body. When I go out in the vines, I feel the soil around, the nature around, and it resonates inside me. And when I was 5 years old, I started, you know, to taste the grape juice from the winery tank. And it has been like, you know, in my system from that moment. All our life is connected to our terroir. All our life is connected to this rhythm also, you know, the cycle of life where you have winter, you prune, then you have spring coming, the new birds, and then you have the summer when it's hot and it's cooking and it's starting to approach the moment where you're going to have this harvest period where it's, it's coming, it's there. And all that life is regulated by those cycles. Well, yeah, it's more than a way of life. I don't know, a connection. That's the best way to describe it, a deep connection.
Beautiful. Well, thank you both for sharing. I look forward to continuing this conversation with the both of you on our second episode. In the meantime, for anyone who's interested and want to know a little bit more about either or both of these beautiful products, you can check out iconicterroirsofeurope.com. We'll include the link in the show description as well. And Taz, Raphael, thank you so much for your time. I look forward to chatting with you again on our next episode.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for listening to the Vine Pair Podcast, the flagship podcast of the Vine Pair Podcast Network. If you love listening to this show, or even if you don't, but I really hope that you do, as much as we really do love making it, then please drop us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get your podcast, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere. If you are listening to this on a device right now through an app, however you got this audio, please drop a review. It really helps everyone else discover the show. And now for some totally awesome credits. So, the Vine Pair Podcast is recorded in our New York City headquarters and in Seattle, Washington, in Zach Chabal's basement. It is recorded by Zach, mastered and produced by Zach. He loves all the credit. Keep giving it to him. Drop his name in the reviews. He's going to love hearing how much you love him. It is also recorded in New York City by our tastings director, Keith Beavers, who is the managing director of the entire Vine Pair Podcast Network. I'd also love to give a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Joanna Sherino, who joins us on every single podcast as our third and most important host. Thank you as well to the entire Vine Pair staff and everyone who's been involved in making Vine Pair as special as it's become. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.